Good evening. Thank you all for coming to the Foreign Correspondents Club this evening. I'm Keith Bradshaw with the New York Times. I'll be your host this evening on behalf of the professional committee here. Before we get started, let me do a little bit of housekeeping. First of all, please, everybody, check your cell phones. Make sure that they're either off or on mute. We always video these to put them up on our website afterwards. It's a shame when we have these little beep-beeps and people can't hear quite that key word that somebody said. Next, I'd like to tell you particularly about a couple of the dinners we have coming up, since you're an audience who's shown your interest in coming to dinners as opposed to our usual lunches. Next Monday, the 14th, we have Mike Chinoy, whom many of you know, a longtime club member, a CNN journalist, now also in Southern California. He's doing a series called Assignment China on foreign correspondence in China from World War II up to the present. And he'll be airing the first of his series of documentaries here next Monday evening, the 14th. The following Monday, the 21st, we have the current Malaysian Minister for Government Accountability. He's actually a very prominent businessman as well in Malaysia. He was the CEO of Malaysian Airlines and oversaw its very dramatic turnaround. And so he's somebody who I think might interest a lot of you, both from the economics perspective — he's in charge of a lot of economic policy there — as well as from the business perspective. This evening, Professor Chun is somebody who's combined a lot of different talents. He's been a professor in the United States for the past 20 years, but he's also the chief economist for a venture capital firm in Shanghai, and he's a senior researcher with the Chinese Academy of Social Sciences. And he also has really good advice for his students. One of his former students came up to him this evening before we started dinner and said, "Oh, I remember your class in international trade." And so my colleague Tom here from The Economist asked, "Well, what do you really remember from the course?" And tried to give an instant quiz. But what she really remembered was that she'd gone by his office, Professor Chun's office, after class, and asked his advice on what was really going on in the world. And based on that advice, in 2002, she and her family bought gold and Shanghai real estate, both of which have done well since then. So with that, I give you Professor Chun. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Keith, and thank you very much, Tom. And thanks for everyone coming over and enjoy the food here. And when my student walked to me and asked me, "Do you recognize me, you know, 8 years ago?" And when Keith and Tom started quizzing her, I told my students, "Hey, you know, I can always go back to change your grade." Well, I wish that I took my own advice in 2002. That's what the professor does, right? And the professor, they always teach, they don't do it. You know, those who do not know what to do, they teach. So that's what we do here. So I didn't know when I was invited, they sent me emails, "Hey, you want to come to talk to FCC?" I have no clue what FCC was. You know, I have no idea. I didn't know there's a foreign correspondence. And after that, they told me there's a foreign correspondence club. I look at this, geez, I have to go back to China tomorrow. You know, if you see me that tomorrow still running on the street, probably there's something I said wrong here tonight. So Keith wants me to talk about this, the IMB and all those things. So I have I don't want to make things too complicated. I have these are three very simple questions here. Number one is that what does the IMB exchange look like in the future? And that's a very tough question, actually. You know, I mean, economists try to distance themselves from astrologists, and because forecasting future is suicidal. You know, anyone you want to be discredited, you just do the forecast of future. Yeah. And so, but I think that I'm going to take a bold leap forward tonight and do something which is quite unusual for my profession and in the past several years. So I'm going to forecast the future, but forecast future based on some assumptions. So there's some caveat there, and you have to, and if you want to quote, you don't quote 50%, you have to quote 100%. And the second question, how does that affect China's labor cost? And the third question, that if that is the case, how does that how does Chinese companies do, you know, to cope with that? So these are three questions, right? So in order to answer these three questions, let's see what happened so far. Where are we coming from? So here is where we're coming from. And this is started from 2002. Now, we all know that in 1994, when the Chinese woke up, January 1st, 1994, the Chinese woke up, they found that, that their asset in terms of dollar depreciated by close to 60%. That's a huge devaluation at the time in 1994. And Chinese export became enormously competitive. And that was part of the things that people blame the Southeast Asia financial crisis, blame on China. That's part of the reason some people blame on that. But then if you look at going to the year 2000 and at the 8.27, the appreciation pressure started building up. And particularly if you look at this, this is the two line here, the green line is the RMB spot exchange rate that you see on the airport. You know, that's what you buy. The blue line, this is the 1 year non-deliverable forward. Basically, that's the forward contract in RMB in forecast future. In toward the early 2000, my friend, I was talking to Keith Yigam, who is currently vice president of People's Bank of China and director of SAFE, called the State Administration of Foreign Exchange. You know, that's a very good name for Chinese currency. It's in a safe. And he wrote a research paper jointly with another faculty professor in Australia National University, Professor Song Li Gang. That was the paper they cooked up while he was still in Beijing University. And in that paper, basically, he was arguing that Chinese currency was undervalued and moving toward the market mechanism, you should have Chinese currency to appreciate. And then there was it was presented in the research conference, then it was quoted in the Wall Street Journal and the New York Times, and it's become big blows because Yigang at the time was the member of People's Bank's Monetary Policy Committee. And the Wall Street Journal actually literally say that the People's Bank of China official predicting, arguing Chinese currency should appreciate. And suddenly, if you look at an NDF and forecasting suddenly dip down and forecasting IMB should appreciate. So this is what we see that in the past. On August 27 or 25th, I don't exactly remember the day, suddenly Chinese currencies and appreciate a huge amount. Since then, up to today, to the end of 2010, IMB has been appreciating 3.5%. And a year, every year. That including this this period in 08 and 09, that's relatively stable. And by the way, in 2010, 1 year, RMB appreciated about 3%. So that's what happened in exchange rate. Now, everyone is arguing that Chinese currency is undervalued, you know, they should appreciate. But at the same time, it's generally people believe that Chinese inflation is higher than outside the world. We all know that inflation is caused by printing too much money. So if too much money makes the money cheaper, so shouldn't that Chinese higher inflation indicates that the Chinese currency should depreciate, right? And so in fact that this is the inflation that we saw in the past, that the average inflation rate, if you count from the 1978 after the reform, is about 5%. 4.9%, right? And certainly the year 2000 was relatively low, but now you see the inflation rate picking up close to 5%. The Chinese government, the National Bureau of Statistics just published the inflation data in February. Conveniently, the number was 4.9%, less than 5. Great, that's because they have a very important meeting in Beijing. You need to make sure the inflation rate is below 5%. And what happened was that they changed the weight. So they lower the weight on the food, increase the weight on the housings. And the housing price, you know, in the past didn't change that much, and the food price has gone up crazy, right? So, but after calculating, it's 4.9%. Nice. And this is, you know, they do this kind of things, you know. So don't quote me on this, right? I mean, so this is a Shanghai Stock Exchange does that same thing, right? I mean, in a bull market, they include IPO stocks, so that you see that the numbers goes up high. In the bear market, the IPO the stocks is only included 1 month later. So anyway, so a lot of decisions to be made for that. U.S. inflation on average in the same period is about 2.6%. So on average, Chinese inflation is higher than the U.S. inflation. That should indicate that Chinese currency should be cheaper. What happened here is, I'll come back to this point. And this is the money, this is the pseudo money in the past. You see there's a two big peak. The one peak is the beginning of 2008. How many minutes did I have? 25 minutes, okay. I thought the whole night. Yeah. 2008, first, that's the big peak. That's because of Lehman Brothers. So they're scared, they're pumping a lot of money. And then in 2009, they saw the economy is slow, and there's 22 million people. You know, some people say that the 22 million in the East Coast, and the migrant worker don't find a job. So government's scared, you know, they pump a 25% increase of the money. And on average, it's 15% growth. And in fact, the goal, according to the premier's the report, the National Congress report, the goal in the next few years is 16%, so more like in the normal. But in 2009, there's 10% more money in the market. Where does money go? This money will show up somewhere. And lots of money goes to the state-owned enterprises, goes to the real estate, and the housing prices. So what happened the Chinese government is doing now is finding the exiting strategy. How to withdraw those money out of the market, those 10% extra. So, so another thing that I want to bring your attention here is that the labor cost. Labor cost has been growing. This is the three, four different colors, different lines. Labor cost has been growing on average about 14.2% after the year 2000. It's much faster. And you notice that the red line is SOE, state-owned enterprises. State-owned enterprises increase. They have been capturing bigger pie, right? And working for state-owned enterprises have been living a good time. There's a rural township enterprise does not increase that high. So that the in terms of GDP pie, the income in the rural sectors gets smaller as you know, they're growing, they get more money, but the pie gets smaller. So this is the increase of the labor cost. So what happened to the exchange rate? So this is the question that I'm going to ask, right? So this is the red line is the exchange rate. I said that suppose the Chinese exchange rate, Chinese currency, would maintain the same pace as 3.5% appreciation. Okay? Suppose hypothetically it can still maintain, but that's assumption, you can question this. But my guess is that given that the Chinese People's Bank of China, they wanted to move moving toward faster to the market mechanism of Chinese currency, and probably they would maintain the similar 3.5% of growth increase appreciation. This blue line shows the equilibrium exchange rate of the RMB. Right? Now, everyone said that the RMB is undervalued. Undervalued to what? Right? There must be equilibrium exchange rate. Now, I don't know the equilibrium exchange rate. Nobody knows what is the actual RMB value should be. So I take the Big Mac, you know, this is the famous Economist magazine, the Big Mac things as a proxy. I say, hey, you know, why not just play around to see what happened. So with China inflation 4.9%, if China can maintain less than 5% inflation, and if United States not massively printing the money, still maintain 2.6%, that is, this is what I'm using the past to forecast future. So I just want to play around to see what happened. Right? So that would indicate this blue line, which is the equilibrium exchange rate, the Chinese currency should, the equilibrium Chinese yuan should depreciate at this pace. And eventually these two lines would intersect at this point, at this year 2021. And at this point, the gap between the market exchange rate that you see on an airport and equilibrium will close to zero. The gap disappear. And that is probably, if this is all the assumptions true, this is probably the time, the best time to free the market, let exchange rate to be determined by the market, and that has the minimum shock during this time period, about 10 years. So I also play around with this different price inflation differential. Suppose US inflation goes crazy. So the inflation between China and the US is the inflation differential is 1%. And that will lead you to 2024 sometimes. And or it could be the Chinese inflation becomes 8%, the US inflation 3%. Right? And the 5% inflation differential, that leads you to 2015. So that shows you the ballpark figure of equilibrium exchange rate, probably is between 4 and 5, probably 10, 15 years. I also played around with exchange rate appreciation about 3%, and that'll give you different numbers at different years. But ballpark figure give you about 10 to 15 years. The gap between equilibrium and actual exchange rate probably will disappear by that time. And so that'll give you, if you have, by that time, if Chinese inflation is still higher than the United States, that'll indicate the Chinese currency should depreciate. By the time, maybe that's the time that they should sell your house in Shanghai and buy one in Beverly Hills. That's good timing, you know, 10 years. So that's what happened. And so what happened to the labor cost? So I also did the same thing, and based on suppose labor cost increase, the wage rate increase, still maintain 14.2% as in the past. Whether this assumption is reasonable or not? Well, in the past, this is why the thing people think that the Chinese labor increase is not catching up the speed of GDP increase, the economy goal. So the labor pie in the GDP gets smaller. And so this, the Chinese government wants to change that. They want to increase the local domestic consumption, increase the income. So might be even higher than 14.2%. I don't know. So I just want to play around with this. And this another red one is, suppose China, so labor costs increase by 12%. This is all in terms of dollar, in terms of dollar, that's based on exchange rate that I did in the previous slide. Where did I get this 12%? The 12% is based on if Premier Wen Jiabao can keep his promise that the GDP grows at 8% and inflation maintained at 4%. And so the nominal GDP grows at 12%, suppose the labor grows about the same pace. And that gives you that by toward the end of this year, it means that the Chinese labor costs in terms of dollar would quadruple, or the triple would quadruple. And that would shows that this how this labor cost would imply here. Now, this is not my data. This is data coming from Economist magazine. And they, they also indicated that Chinese labor cost by 2018 is about a quadruple. So I mean, so pretty much similar in terms of forecast. Yeah, so what the question here is that what a company, you know, if I'm running a company, what should I do? And some companies, okay, let's go to Sichuan. Let's go to the inland area. Now, if you look at this, the average way the labor compensation across different provinces, it's not much different. The labor cost saving is not much. It's not that much. You could go there. You can go to Jiangxi province, but you have to. If you export sector, you have to ship the goods out, and you have to go to with the shipping cost is high, right? So go to the inland. The labor cost can keep bringing some of the savings, but not as much that as many people thought. And must be something else on top of the labor costs attract those companies moving to the inland, and probably because of the government incentives, probably because of the local booming market. So all these are the possibilities. So after presenting all these things, here are the key points that I want to strike, and that I want to is that a takeaway that people can have for this. I think that the IMB appreciation would keep the maintain the pace. We'll continue with this 3.5 pace and down to the road. And the reason behind this is because the assumption is because current monetary policy in the US and the political pressure built up by the Western countries, and as well as China's strategic shift moving toward to the domestic consumption, domestic economy. And they do not want to penalize domestic consumption. And they do not want to subsidize American consumption at the expense of the domestic consumers. Second point I want to bring up too is that IMB will likely to close the gap with its equilibrium exchange rate probably in like 10 or 15 years. And maybe that's the time, there's 10 to 15 years a window for the People's Bank of China to reform all to complete all the reform that they necessary so that, that they can install this market mechanism for the Chinese currency, RMB. The third point I want to say that is that if China maintains similar high growth and its labor cost is likely, in terms of dollar, likely to triple or quadruple by the end of this year and probably approaching the cost of Taiwan. The last point is that I want to make is that the companies moving inland really does not command a high, huge labor cost savings. So the point here is that it's a manufacturing company, what do you do? I think the technology innovation is very important. Vertical integration is very important. The adopting capital intensive method is very important. Streamline the process, make it more efficient is more important. Now, before I came to this talk to Hong Kong, I purposely flew to Zhuhai. And we have some students, our alum, alum of our global executive MBA program that we have in Shanghai. They graduate and they run their companies. So I visited them, two companies. And one is, I just want to show you that I'm not faking it. You know, actually, I was there. And so this is a tofu company. This is a tofu company, and they make a tofu. They sell to different part of the world. You know, interestingly, the company's very capital intensive. Actually, they overinvested. They have a huge amount of capital. In the beginning, was very capital intensive. And they thought that China would buy this kind of tofu from them. You know, China's, that tofu is very expensive, of course, you know, made by machine, right? So in the end, the Chinese didn't really buy lots of this tofu. The tofu goes out to outside of China, go to Japan, those expensive places. But now, many, many other companies, Chinese companies, in the beginning, they're very labor intensive, but now the Chinese company can become a more capital install more machines. The cost of the Chinese tofu gets higher, higher. And so now they realize that they become relatively a little more competitive in Chinese market. So they'll start selling the market, the tofu in China. So that's one company I visited. And there's also another company I visited that I was also there and I was not making a, this is a shoe company. It's called Glory Shoes Industrial Limited. It's run by our class number three, Global Executive MBA in Shanghai. This is the largest function boots company in the world. They employ 10,000 people. And Paul, standing next to me, and he runs this factory, 7,000 people. Right? And I tour this. They make Timberland boots, the caterpillar cats, and Bates, Wolflings, and all kinds of boots that are your hiking boots, very likely coming from his factory. You go to New York City. You see the policemen wear the boots, very likely coming from his company. I asked him, how does this wage increase affect your operation? He said, "Oh, that's a huge amount. They have been considering this. They have been diversifying. They have been investing in Bangladesh. They have setting a shop in Vietnam." He said, "In the end, after calculating all the shipping costs and taking into account of the labor ethics of the people in Bangladesh, turns out to be not much saving. And probably they can do better in China." Then I ask a question, how do you do better in China? Well, it's that increasing, making the process more efficient. For example, they installed ERP system 3 years ago. Before that, there was no ERP system. Everything was on paper. And the ERP system installed. And before that, the inventory was $15 million a day. They have $15 million US dollar a day inventory, and the turnover rate for the inventory is 46 days. And with the ERP system, the inventory reduced to $7 million, and the turnover rate becomes 2 weeks, 14 days. So that becomes more efficient. And the machines, they can make the machines. I saw there's a machine that the one person punched the hole, the other one put the buttons on that. And he said that they have a machine now, and they can do just two things at one time. So you can save one labor. So the process like this, capital-intensive production mechanism, and the more efficient the production process will make the production more efficient, and also vertical integration. I once visited a company which is a textile company, you know, making clothes. They make clothes from the cotton to the yarn to the cloth to dye it and cutting, and the last one is stitching and sewing, and then shipping out. It's wholly completely integrated. And if you look at this production line, it is very capital intensive. And it's capital intensive all the way to the point of cutting. And cutting is by the laser, you know, laser cutting of the cloth. And once it's been cut into pieces, then it's been starting stitching and sewing them, becomes very labor intensive. You see all the rows of girls just stitching that. Now, for companies who are highly integrated, they'd be able to absorb the cost, able to make it more efficient. For those companies not integrated, you're seeing those companies moving to Vietnam, moving to other places, and gradually disappear. These are companies that only focus on the labor-intensive part. So this is, I asked the guy that, are you going to move into the England? He said, no. They are the OEM for Nike's, or their products selling overseas, the shipping cost to them will be high. So they stay in Suzhou, which is a very expensive place. So this is my key, the things that I want to talk about. So I think, I don't know, I mean, how the time goes. And I do have I have my email and my website that if you want to check them into me, and I'd be happy to leave it to for Q&A. I hope that this is just the things that for people, entice people to think and try to be a little provocative so people can ask more questions that they say that so that tonight we can be more stimulating. Thank you.
Okay, well, thank you. Who would like to throw out the first question? Please identify yourselves. Here we have one right now. Bonnie?
You know, how do you do? My name's Bonnie Engel. I write about Asian art, so I'm not exactly a financial wizard, but thank you for this talk. It's been most enlightening because we keep reading in the paper about the labor costs in China going way up. But to bring it home, we in Hong Kong are tied to the U.S. dollar.
Right.
So I guess the question in most Hong Kong people's minds is, what will happen when we have to convert our Hong Kong dollar to renminbi?
When the systems convert linked to renminbi,
yeah,
okay.
Hot.
Yeah, that's actually a very good question. And, the mainland China is the largest trading partner of Hong Kong. So in terms of economics principle, it makes sense to link Hong Kong dollar to the Chinese RMB, you know, because this is what you do your most of your business and you want to, this is where your risk is coming from. So it makes sense to link with the Chinese RMB. Now, but I also see the reasons from the other side that you shouldn't link with the Chinese RMB because the inflation in China is higher. And the currency is not completely convertible in China. And there's more risk in China. So currently, seems to be that the Hong Kong government actually today, and the chief administrator of Hong Kong was talking about they are not going to de-link Hong Kong dollar with the U.S. dollar, and they want to link. They will maintain the link and maintain as it is. But who knows? Because they can change it instantaneously. Right? The one moment they say that everyone got a 6,000 Hong Kong dollar, the next day say, hey, you know. So I don't know. I mean, so it's going to be very political. My personal guess is that probably they will maintain it as is for the moment, and the time that it comes will be very sudden. That's a good bet, actually. That's a good bet. Yeah.
Okay. Why don't we take one here and then Martin next?
Hi, Professor Chen. Thanks for your comments. This topic that you're covering tonight is actually quite hugely debated, looking at inflation-adjusted exchange rates as some kind of indication of where the valuation is going.
Right.
But it's still quite under quite a bit of controversy because, you know, as you know, if you dig out the textbooks, it's actually unit labor costs that actually determine the competitiveness of your goods in international markets. And one counter-argument against adjusting the exchange rate by headline inflation is that you ignore productivity adjustments. I was hoping that tonight through your comments, because you take a maybe a different perspective, look at companies, look at it from the micro level, if you could maybe provide some insight as to which of these sides is true, because people who look at adjustments by headline inflation say, look, the renminbi has actually appreciated quite a bit, so it's actually moving in the right direction. But those who try to productivity adjust it say, actually, because productivity adjustments have outpaced wage growth, that in fact the renminbi is moving in the wrong direction. This, so I was wondering if you had maybe a grassroots level insight as to which side of this debate actually holds more water.
Right. This is very it's a very complicated question, and I'm not sure that many people understand that, because there's lots of economics in it. Well, the thing is that I compare the nominal exchange rate. So in a comparison of a nominal exchange rate, equilibrium nominal exchange rate, you don't need to put the productivity in it because that's the real term. But when you calculate the real exchange rate, there's another way to look at this is calculate the real exchange rate. When you calculate the real exchange rate, then the real cost of the labor, and that's in fact in terms of calculation. And that's another way to look at it. In terms of labor cost, the company, when the company make a decision, so where you're going to produce the products or not, it's not just the labor cost, it's not the labor, the wage. It's not the wage is an important consideration. Productivity is a very important consideration, and that is why when I talk to my students that, what happened to Bangladesh, the wage is low. But they said productivity is low too. So that they cancel the advantage the company, the production they have, the shipping to, they move their production to Bangladesh. And which, for whatever reasons, I asked him why the labor productivity in Bangladesh is low. He said, he didn't give me other things. He said, the work ethic is quite different. People there just don't work that hard. Now, people in Bangladesh are happy people, they enjoy life. They don't like to work that. So that's his answer. But I think that to a large extent is also the skills, the experience, and also in terms of the supply chain, all these things affects the productivity of the operation of the company in other countries. So yes, the labor productivity is a very important consideration, and that is why that I say that not necessarily company will leave China. And go to, the wage in China has gone up, let's just pack and leave, go to Vietnam. Not necessarily so. And you will see that if you be able to compensate this with the productivity increase, and you'll be able to compete in the global market. So that's the short answer to your very long questions. Yes, yeah.
But as they invest more capital, productivity actually goes up even more.
Yes.
So that's actually an argument that the renminbi needs to appreciate much faster. Because
must be appreciated.
Must nominally appreciate much faster, because as you observe in the factories in Zhuhai, companies are tooling up much quicker, and therefore the unit labor costs actually may in fact be going down. And the renminbi getting increasingly competitive, even though
the real exchange rate, the renminbi in the real terms,
correct,
becomes more and more competitive. Yes, in the real terms.
Which means your equilibrium exchange rate actually will, rather than pointing out the Big Mac index depreciating over time, it may actually be appreciating over time.
Or in other words, maybe it's a 3 RMB to the dollar instead of 4 RMB is the long-term equilibrium if you allow for a lot of productivity growth. Is that what you're suggesting?
Possibly.
Yeah.
There's a big debate because there are some fundamental questions for which, from a macroeconomic perspective, is in disagreement. And my question was, from a micro perspective, when you examine these factories, do you have any insights that may help solve this debate? But maybe we can take this offline if it's getting too...
Right. Well, the short answer is that the exchange rate, if the nominal exchange rate is determined by the relative prices, okay, it's relative prices. So the higher inflation means that you have more money, the money is cheaper. So that if it's the nominal exchange rate that determined by the purchasing power parity by the we're going to get into the economics class here now, by the Big Mac index, that would indicate that the Chinese would depreciate. Now, in terms of real exchange, there's another way to calculate this. The real exchange, that's a different story. That's you have to calculate. I'm not going to go into that details that they're going to calculate throughout the formulas to calculate this, right? So that's what you're talking about is the real exchange rate part, not the nominal exchange rate. Nominal exchange is determined by the inflation differential in the long term.
And next, Marty, our resident shoe expert.
The shoe expert.
Yes, but I'm more interested in the convertibility issue. How soon the equilibrium comes, whether it's 5 years or 20 years, do you expect the government actually to free up and go to market convertibility?
Oh.
And corollary to that is, I was surprised that you didn't mention the huge amounts of US dollar assets that are held by China. That must in some ways have impact the willingness to have free convertibility of the renminbi.
Yes, I don't know when. Right? Now, if this prediction is correct, and it means that they have to get these things done in 10 to 15 years windows if they want to do these things, right? I don't know when that they were completely free. But if you look at the comparison here, today is the convertibility is much freer today than before. And now you can wire out $50,000 without a question. And I have seen people wiring $1 million, $2 million out of China without a question. Right. So if you want to do it, they can do it. And when there's completely that free flow, you can wire millions, 10 million, 20 million, I don't know. I mean, if they really want to make it a complete flow, that means that they have to follow this about 10 to, they have 10 to 15 years window time to do that. And your second question is?
Well, just the, doesn't the huge foreign exchange reserves impact the exchange rate?
That's a very interesting question here. You know, there's a huge foreign exchange reserve here. That certainly that increased the confidence of the policymaker that they are more comfortable that they'd be able to appreciate, convert it, and also put pressure on the government because every time when a dollar coming in, you need to sterilize it. And otherwise, that means that the Chinese has been, I'm sorry, when every dollar coming in, they have to issue the RMB to buy it, and which means there's more liquidity in the market. And in order to avoid this liquidity, the impact of liquidity in the market, they have to sterilize it by issuing bond. The more doing this, the more difficult to sterilization. And so there's the pressure on appreciation of RMB is high with a huge amount of foreign exchange reserve. But this is also it's a dilemma here. You know, the faster that you appreciate, the faster your asset depreciate. So that's the dilemma that the Chinese People's Bank of China is facing this. And so this is what we're seeing here that they are doing a minimal stick approach. They have been decreasing its foreign exchange reserve in terms of dollar, shifting to other currencies. So now we're seeing that the dollar is probably account about 60% of the foreign exchange reserve, and the rest of it across the board are the euros and diversifying that, try to diversify the risk. But there is no free lunch, Right? You want to do something, you want to achieve one goal, that you have a cost associated with this. You want a free exchange, you have the market-determined exchange rate, you have to suffer because you have this huge amount of asset in your account. So what they can do is now try to minimize the impact and by diversifying this and getting slowly, step by step.
Okay. Next, while you're thinking of the next one, why don't I throw one in here, which is the labor minister said in Beijing today that China does not have a labor shortage. It only has a shortage of assembly line workers in some coastal areas. Would you agree with that?
They have 1.3 billion people and it could potentially be 1.5 billion. And was the other 0.2 billion is a statistic error, which is a two-thirds of the size of the United States. They certainly have lots of people there. Right? And what we're seeing here is that the so-called the cheap labor in the past, and it's going to be much more difficult to find. Which that indicates that the wage that being offered in the past probably is under the equilibrium, less than equilibrium that they could have got. And also the opportunity cost of labor coming to the East Coast and getting higher. Because you know you have to suffer all this separation from your family, coming to the East Coast and earning this wage and go back in home, the wage rate is relatively low. But it's not as much as before now, so why bother? So that, and also we're seeing some companies moving to the East and provide a job opportunity there. And that put pressure on in the East Coast, and that's also built up a pressure on the wage rate in the East Coast. And so that, in a sense that if they don't change the wage rate in the East Coast, they will have labor shortage. And if you know, in order to avoid this, the wage rate has to go up.
Okay. Out on the veranda, please.
So yeah, with the real exchange rate and the nominal exchange rate, at what point did the Chinese yuan become so undervalued? Because I remember in like 1994, you know, when you'd go to the black market,
you wouldn't
necessarily be getting, you know, a market rate that was so, you know, so very much different from now. And yet you're claiming that because China's inflation is faster than the US over all this period, that there's some narrowing in the gap. This is quite a new, this whole sort of simplistic approach of different consumer price inflation, therefore you can chart the two things. There's quite a new approach that Geithner has been talking about, and it seems to ignore, you know, the massive trade surplus, the foreign exchange reserves, the higher interest rates in China, lower interest rates in the US.
Right.
Why has everyone suddenly simplified the debate?
Well, that's a good point, actually. You know, I just want to be as simple as possible. Try to be in a simple diagram to explain the things, right? So this is what I'm doing here. Whether these things is real actual exchange, I don't know. Nobody really know where the exchange rate is. I'm just using this as a proxy. And the truth probably somewhere in between or somewhere, I mean, somewhere. I really don't know here. And I think the exchange rate, my hunch is that the Big Mac, I try to mathematically prove that the Big Mac in exchange rate is the actual exchange rate is in between somewhere, but I couldn't, and I'll try to build up a model to do this, but leave that aside. But this is the simple approach and try to see what happened. Now, all we know that this exchange rate, the Chinese currency, is undervalued. And undervalued to what? The equilibrium, right? That's that part we know that. Now, so if Chinese inflation rate is higher than the US inflation rate, and then we know that equilibrium exchange rate should appreciate. And so somewhere that there is a gap is getting closer and closer. Now, as the gap gets closer, the trade balance would reflect this the narrowing of the gap. The reason, that one argument is that the reason that the Chinese goods is relatively more competitive is because Chinese currency is relatively undervalued. But once the gap gets narrowed down, the current account or the trade balance can, maybe itself will reflect it in the future with the market will automatically adjust and fall. Maybe China will buy more things from the US. So, under which point that the Chinese currency will be undervalued? I don't know. I mean, if you buy this idea, in about 10 or 15 years, and they still maintain the fixed exchange rate, if they still run as high inflation, and that is the time probably that would experience the undervaluation, overvaluation of the Chinese currency. And then there was, if the overvaluation becomes high, then you see the black market will occur, which is, that was before 1994. Before 1994, the huge black market in China, and there was, you know, there's two currencies in China in 1994. One is called RMB, the other one is called FEC. For those people old enough, you know this. And if a dollar you go there, you get a 1-to-1. And $1, you get a 1 FEC, right? And I'm sorry, the 1 yuan equal to 1 1 FEC, I mean, the other way around. I don't know exactly remember, but it's getting, that's in old days. Right. So basically, that you get FEC, you got the privilege to buy things in the friendship stores. So you can, in a friendship store, you can use FEC to buy a cereal, cheese, milk that ordinary Chinese are not able to buy. And so that's a way that the Chinese to show the friendship to foreigners. You know, they rip you off, right? You know, coming in, you know, they give you FEC, and you buy things in a friendship store. That's how we show our friendship to you guys. That's the black market that indicates at the time. Remember, on the street, that was $1 give you 10 and 11 RMB at the time. That was the time when the exchange rate, one US dollar equal to 3 point something Chinese RMB. That was official exchange rate.
So if the market rate was 10 all those years ago, the nominal rate all those years ago, and yet you've got higher inflation in China than you have in the US, then, you know, how come you're arguing that the market rate should now be weaker for the renminbi?
Well, that was the time in 1994 that high inflation in China indicates that the Chinese currency set in the airport, 3 point, let's just make it 3.5, is very much overvalued. Right? It was very much overvalued. So that's why in the black market, $1 equal to 10 and 12. And so that's why they devalue the Chinese currency to 8.7. That was the 1994, right? So still, the high inflation indicates that the currency should depreciate. Right, that was 1994, and that's...
It's about time for us to wrap up. Is there one last question here? Somebody? Yes, over here.
Hi, my name is Lilian Liu. I was wondering whether the wage growth rate may not be as fast as the numbers suggest here, because the number of skilled workers is actually shrinking, and the Chinese population, they are aging.
Yeah.
And also, I wonder, are we talking about a wage of the factory workers or a national average?
Yeah.
Because now each year, like more than 6 million university graduates, many of them couldn't find a job, and many are happy to take lower salaries.
Okay. This is the average wage. It's including everything, right? Including the state-owned enterprises. They don't give you breakdown statistics like the manual labor, white-collar labor. So there's everyone working in the state-owned enterprise. This is the wage. Okay. Now, try to find the manufacturing wage in the National Bureau of China Statistics yearbook. I don't find that. I believe that the Economist magazine, this is the manufacturing wage in the manufacturing sector. That's the wage increase. And so this is, you try to compare different from different sides, different evidence to see whether cross-check if they are accuracy or not, at least give us ballpark figure, right? The question is that the university student cannot find a job? You do find that, right? I mean, there's the things that was like 2005, I don't exactly remember. Suddenly there's more university in China. And what happened was like all those 3-year college suddenly become 4-year universities. Suddenly you have a huge number of people so working there, in the college. And that means that give you 4 years delay, so you would see there's a large chunk of graduates coming to the market toward 2009. 2008, 2009, during the time. I have to go back to check when they started this reform, the education reform. Now this enormous number of people graduate, get in the market, they need to be absorbed. So that's a shock. And that's a short-term thing. So that's not a long-term phenomena. It's only one time during the time suddenly coming. And the market respond that well. And today, that's official statistics coming from a university that 75% of college graduates got a job offer 2 months before graduation. Official statistics. Right? I mean, whether this is, you can question this as some university, you're seeing the evidence that the university, because they're self-interest, they ask each student, before you graduate, you have to receive an offer. So if you don't receive an offer, I'm not going to give you a graduation degree. The book, I'm not going to give it to you. So all these students go talk to their mom and pop, they ask their uncles, give them an offer, just hire me for 2 months. And they've been hired, they receive the offer, they show the university letter, say, hey, I'm being employed, and 2 months later, they walk on the street, and who cares? Because statistics show the university has 75% of being employed, but I don't have this data, what happened after 2 months. I once asked some labor economist in China, do you have a statistics there? Well, they haven't collected the survey data of that yet. So that's how I try to answer the university college. Certainly is that it also depends on the experience. For those college graduates and don't have a good experience, you have to start a very low cheap wage position. And if you have a large chunk of this, there's a grid there, and that's what we've seen in the past.
Thank you very much for coming. Let's all give him a hand.
Thank you very much.
We always like to give our guests something to remember the club by.
Oh,
hope it's
great.
In your size. Thank you very much for coming.
Thank you. Thank you very much. I hope I'll be able to cross the border tomorrow.